Great. Thank you so much. And thank you guys all for being here. I'm really excited just to hear the other presentations with making frantic notes about all the things I want to follow up with you on. So I'm excited to be here also to share a little bit more about our work in California. So I have no relationships to disclose. And so I was actually asked today to help bring all this down and give a real life example of what health and all policies looks like on the ground, and to try to touch a little bit on the earlier presentations, or at least the themes from the earlier presentations. So in California in 2010, we had a governor's executive order that created the Health and All Policies Task Force. And the task force brings together 22 different departments from across the state government, and brings them all together to work on health-related topics. And so a couple just important keys about the task force. So they report actually to a multi-agency level cabinet body called the Strategic Growth Council. So it's not, they don't report to the Department of Public Health specifically, they report to a separate body altogether. And that this effort is not owned by the Department of Public Health. We help the public health to help staff the task force, but we don't actually own the work. So I think that's actually really important in thinking about things where we're working with other departments and agencies to make sure that they actually have ownership over the work. And I also, I just wanted to, you know, I was jotting down notes as the other presenters were speaking. When we think about health and all policies from where, from our work in California, we actually really think about the little p policy. So we don't think about as much legislation and big p policies coming out of the legislature. Instead, we think about the little piece, so process, programs, grants, guidelines, all the things that governments do to implement those laws and regulations coming down. And there's a lot of flexibility in what can be done, you know, outside of the formal law, legislative and lawmaking process. So how do we do this? So we focus really on the relational or the cultural aspect of collaboration. So I should also mention that while we had an executive mandate to bring all these different departments together, there was, of course, no money to do anything together. So everybody is continue to come back to the table now in our almost our sixth year because we are working on meeting and identified shared goals and really working to do what we call the identify the co-benefits. So we are working first to meet their goals, and as we're meeting their goals, we're looking to see how we can bring in the embedding health and equity into what they're already doing. So we don't create new programs for the most part. We really work on improving those existing programs and processes that already exist, and looking for the opportunities to really embed health and equity. All right. And so one key way we do that is through the health lens. And so I wanted to actually just touch back on what Ariel was saying about health impact assessments. At the task force, we actually have not utilized any health impact assessments. And there's a few reasons why. The biggest one is when we first started in 2010, the task force said, don't make us do health impact assessments. Whatever you do, don't make us do it. Like, so it was off the table from the get-go, and so we had to figure out other ways of thinking about how do we, you know, what other tools exist to embed this health inequity. And so instead of actually focusing on more formal HIAs, we do the health lens analyses. And so there's some really great examples coming out of South Australia about what a formal health lens analysis process can look like, and I recommend looking on their website if you're interested. We haven't done it in so much of a formal way, so we don't have a, they have a really nice guideline on how they've done it. We don't have a formal guideline. Ours is much more opportunistic and really a little bit more flexible, which is where we kind of have had to find our niche and making sure that we can adapt to what's happening on the ground that given day. So I wanted to specifically focus in and thinking about how we implement this health lens analysis by focusing specifically on our grants programs. So again, this is where we're talking about not creating new healthy community grants programs. There's no money to do that right now. But what we do know is that there are a lot of other departments and agencies out there who are tasked with giving out millions and millions of dollars to local communities. And we know that healthy communities, the actual act of building healthy communities really does happen at that ground level. So if we're able to help influence grants at the state level and other departments and agencies are really thinking about health and equity in those grants, we have the potential to really impact long-term local level health impacts. On the screen here, there's a recommendation. So in our initial, in 2010, when we started, we did a bunch of stakeholder engagement. And one of the recommendations that we got from that stakeholder engagement process was this idea about incorporating health and equity into state grants, request applications, review criteria, scoring, technical assistance, et cetera. And so to date, we've worked on four, so we being the Health and All Policies Task Force and the staff supporting them, focusing on four different grant programs, which amounts to quite a large sum of money when you add it all up. The first two grant programs are actually no longer in existence. They were a short-term bond measure. The latter two around affordable housing and active transportation are actually ongoing appropriations. And with at least the affordable housing grant program, it's set to grow in the coming years. So that's this year is looking, we're looking at $400 million, last year was $120 million, and in future we're actually projected to grow hopefully up to $700, $800 million. Let me check my notes. So, you know, when we're talking about how to actually embed health and equity into these grant-making programs, I think one of the questions that we get a lot is, how do you actually do that? What does that look like on the ground? And I have kind of two different responses. And the first one is, with those first two early grants that I mentioned, there was no legislation, there's no mandate to include health or equity in those grants. And the way that we actually got to the table was first by actually offering those departments to help them actually do the grant reviews. And if any of you've done a grant review, they're very time intensive. So it's no small, you know, amount of resources to actually volunteer to do one of those programs. But what it did is it exposed us to what they were already talking about making grants for, and it helped us build that relationship. So we were sitting at the table helping them review these grants, and so in cycle two, we were then invited to the table to actually help develop those grant guidelines, and then round three, we actually were able to include language around health and equity, and they were actually in terms of measuring both health and equity. So it's a pretty, it's, you know, one of those things, again, it's not legislated anyway, so it's more of a opportunistic strategy to actually try to help embed that related work. And then the second example that, or the second way in which we embed health and equity in California is, we've been really fortunate in the last 8 years or so to actually get some legislation passed that, so specifically around disadvantaged communities. So SB 535 there's the SB 535 coalition that's worked really hard to push equity into state grant making processes. And so this is specifically around California's cap and trade legislation, which is estimated to bring in about $2.2 billion this coming fiscal year. And right now, 25% of that money is required to benefit disadvantaged communities. So that's huge. That's a game changer. And what it's also done is it's meant that a lot of grant programs that aren't under this current cap and trade funding are also starting to adopt this language too, because they're seeing a shift in terms of the communities requiring that they be really heard and make sure that we're taking into consideration disadvantaged communities. The other good thing about this legislation, the SB 535, is it actually also included health as a requirement in all of the money that's given out, that they really need to be considering the co-benefits, so around health, economic benefits, and environmental benefits. And then I'll just add, before moving on, that while we have this legislation now passed around disadvantaged communities, the devil's really in the details, so it's great to have it on paper. You know, it's actually really hard, though, to think about how do you identify disadvantaged communities. And I think in public health, we know who, you know, these are mostly the populations that we're working with. They're the vulnerable populations, the hard-to-reach populations. But then when you get to a grant, state grant-making program, it's actually really hard to figure out what systems you're going to use to identify them. So I can talk more about that if you're interested. Just wanted to throw it out there. So then, the other thing I just wanted to mention on thinking about embedding health and equity into grant making programs is whether or not we do it explicitly or implicitly. An example here is from the Active Transportation Program, which gives about $215 million a year. They also have a requirement to both benefit health and to prioritize disadvantaged communities. And so we have been working on this grant program with the Department of Transportation now for the past 2 years, and we were able to embed direct language around, you know, what will the health benefits be of this active transportation proposal that they're suggesting. And so there's a couple pros and a couple cons that I just wanted to discuss quickly. In terms of pros, I think having explicit language that calls out public health is really great for us in public health in that it helps open the door to and getting a seat at the table. So now they know that they're mandated to embed health. And they came to us and said, we don't know what that means. We don't know how to even start doing that. So it actually was great in terms of opening the door and inviting us to the table. I think it's also great in terms of if we're thinking about monitoring and tracking and grant programs that are adopting health language, we can then do some pretty easy searches and actually say, okay, how many grant programs across the state of California actually have health somewhere in the words? That's a pretty easy search. And then the other thing I'll add is, you know, having health explicitly called out in these grant programs actually helps define a clear role for especially the grantees and specifically local health departments. So we were actually able in this grant program, working through our local health departments, we have 61 local health departments across California, we actually asked them and said, hey, how many of you guys know that this grant program is going on? How many of you guys would like to know that this grant program is going on? And how many would you like to partner with your transportation agencies? And so what we were able to do is included in the actual instructions would say, you know, work with your local health department to identify areas of need, and specifically around either obesity or high rates of morbidity and mortality around accidents and crashes. So it's been really great to actually try to help leverage some of those develop some of those partners at the local level and pushing them, forcing them together. And the other thing that we did at the state level to help support this is actually we went through and identified who at all the local health departments was the primary contact. And so then we helped provide that list to all the applicants across the state to say, like, okay, you don't know who it is at the local health department, let us help you find that right person. Because as you know, some of the local health departments, they're big and they can be bureaucratic in themselves. Some of the cons I will mention about having the explicit language around health is how do you really measure health impact? And I think this is something we struggle with across the board, but we're talking about individual, oftentimes one-time infrastructure improvements, and sometimes non-infrastructure improvements. We're talking about, you know, improving the crosswalk at one intersection, or bulb outs, street bulb outs for pedestrians, or adding maybe a quarter of a mile of bike lane. You know, what is the impact of that small one-time investment on larger public health? So we know if there's been injuries and fatalities, we can probably measure that and a change in that. But in terms of how much does that one crosswalk contribute to decreasing obesity, it's really hard to say. And then at the public health level, you know, we don't even have that data at that localized level. And so we're working with our partners in planning and transportation, and they're saying, where's the data? And we're saying, well, we can't actually show you the data, but we know based on this theory and based on these other studies that when we put it all together, we should see this. But they're like, well, how are we going to report this back out? So I think, you know, there is that challenge and there's that rub there with data. I can answer more questions about those challenges. But the other way we can talk about including health is through implicit health inequity is implicitly. And so this example draws from, it's called the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities Grant Program. This is the one that this year allotted about $400 million for going to affordable housing. I think thinking about implicit, and I think this is probably, especially around things like equity, there are things that public health does better than I would say many other sectors. I think we do community engagement better. And that's nothing against other sectors, but I think it's part of our training, it's embedded in how we think about it when we're working with these vulnerable populations. It's something that we really have to consider. And so I think thinking about when we're developing guidelines with partners, where are there opportunities to actually strengthen some of the guidelines? And so one area in this example that I've worked very closely with other colleagues in local health departments, as well as in Department of Public Health at the state level, and then with advocates, is actually how do we strengthen the community engagement section to make sure that these projects that are ultimately going to receive this money are really meeting the identified demonstrated need of the local communities to make sure that they're actually getting what they need and what they want, as opposed to what some planner or developer somewhere came up with an idea. So that's, I think, one example of how you can think about embedding equity in an implicit way into grant-making programs. some of the quick pros, I do think it's great when we can come into the room and we're not actually talking about health, and we're talking about how we reach their shared goals. And so I think it kind of gets a little bit away from that health imperialism mindset that sometimes I think others have of the health department. Also, I think, again, these are program. A lot of these things are going to happen regardless of whether or not we're at the table. So community engagement is always included in grant-making programs. And if we can work to improve that process, that's great. And so, especially because it's already going to be happening. Some of the quick cons is that when you don't call it out specifically, health and equity can get lost. So there's no easy way to track it and go back and track it and see how we're doing and moving the bar over time. Also, I think it can be really hard sometimes if we're not calling these out specifically to justify why we should be at the table and helping to develop these grant guidelines and then also reviewing them. Oh, sorry, I have one more slide. So really quickly, lessons learned. I think, so we've been doing this work now since 2010, and one of the biggest, I think the most biggest thing that we've learned is that you're not likely to get everything done in the first year, especially with grant-making programs. And luckily, most of these programs occur year and year again. And so, especially with that last example with the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities Program, there were a lot of competing priorities. And so understanding, you know, what was coming down from the governor, what was coming down from the legislature, is health wasn't a really big focus at that time. But what we've, by staying at the table and kind of keeping on pushing and nudging them about it, we've been able to, in the second round, actually been able to do a lot more. And so really seeing those goals or seeing accomplishments, you know, at the iterative process. In terms of stakeholder engagement, it's been really key for us to be able to work with our partners outside of government to make sure that we're aligning what we're talking about inside of government with outside. So we really employ with the California Health and Law Policies Task Force kind of an inside-outside government strategy. And so this has been really helpful, especially around issues that are hard to talk about, like equity. I think most government officials and people actually administering these programs are a little bit afraid to talk about equity, so, but having that outside driving force saying, like, you have to address equity has been really, really important. And then finally, disadvantaged communities. So I mentioned it earlier, the devil's in the details about how you actually operationalize the concept of equity and disadvantage in this case. It's an area we're still struggling around.
Great, so now we have left about 30 minutes exactly for questions and discussion, and so this really is time for you all. I know we're a little different and didn't allow questions in between, so we'll open it up now. If you all would just say your name, where you're from, and your question. No question? Okay, good.
Hi, my name is Hannah.
If you could really yell, sorry, it's a bigger room. Thanks.
Yeah, so the question was about how we define disadvantaged communities, and then there was a second part.
And if there was any criteria.
So it's interesting, the active transportation program did not have a predefined definition, and that was up to basically us in the room that were developing the guidelines. And actually, I would have to give the advocates a lot of credit. They pushed really, really hard to make sure that there was a variety of different ways to define disadvantage. And the active transportation program has an element where they focus on safe routes to schools in addition to infrastructure and other non-infrastructure. So one option is if you're 75% of the school is on free or reduced lunches. Another option was if the median the API was 8% or lower, I believe. So the average price, or it's the housing, it's 8% of the median income basically for the area. There's also something in California that we have is called CalEnviro Screen. And this was it's a tool that was developed by our Environmental Protection Agency that was specifically designed for identified environmental justice communities. And that tool has now been used by a number of different programs to also identify disadvantage. And I think that's where there's maybe a little bit of rub between what defines an environmental justice community versus what's a disadvantaged community. And there are oftentimes the constituent circles, there's a lot of overlap, but there's oftentimes a little bit, there's a few communities that lie probably outside those circles. So they're the four. Oh, and then actually if they could define a way, so if there was an option that said basically choose your own adventure, and if they could validate with data a reason for why they'd consider their population disadvantaged, then they could try to make that case. And then in terms of other considerations that we weren't able to include, I think, especially at least for us in public health, I think we think about income oftentimes as a really, the big determinant of health. And so some of the other grant programs haven't actually had that flexibility in using just an income base. And so that's one area that was, I thought was good to get into the active transportation, but we haven't been as successful in other areas.
Okay, we'll get it to the side. Oh, sorry, first yellow, and then we'll go.
I'll start. I think that's a really hard question, and it's one that I think we've been lucky in that we do have this executive mandate now, and it has established the task force. But there were, before it was formed, there were years and years and years of advocacy work, both in that inside and outside strategy. So we were very lucky to have a supportive Health and Human Service Secretary and Director at the time when the task force was established, who had been already pushing the governor. And then for us, it was also, we were really opportunistic, and I think that's kind of a general theme for all of our work, is that we're flexible. So when the opportunity arose, we were able to kind of just jump on it, and it happened to do, when we were formed under Governor Schwarzenegger, who was a Republican, but was very concerned about climate change and childhood obesity. And so we were able to actually help show him that, one solution to both of those problems is, around active transportation. So we have these, larger scale problems that really can only be solved when we have, people working together across different fields. And so I think he probably had a little bit of an aha moment, but it was a culmination of all these different things. I don't think we have perfect data to support it, but it was more the appealing to what he cared about. And then able to capitalize when we have opportunity.
So the other thing I would say is, I think too often we use the no data as a crutch. And if you go back to what I was saying about thinking about the mechanism, so just because you don't have data to say one particular policy mechanism doesn't, whether it does or doesn't work, is there another situation where we do have evidence that there's a similar mechanism that we can say, hey, look, it worked over here, so let's try it over here. And there's a bunch of different examples where you can go through and make those analogies. But if you're just so rooted in we don't have evidence, or you haven't gone through the process of thinking through what the mechanism is, then you do, and it's a vicious cycle where you say, well, I can't possibly evaluate it because I don't have the data. Okay, we'll just step back for a second and look around. Okay, well, where do we have evidence on different things? What's the mechanism? Oh, okay, so over here, here's how it works. And I think particularly if it's something that is non-threatening to policymakers, they have that aha moment where they say, oh, that's what you're talking about? We can do that. So I think we need to be a little bit more nimble in the way we talk about that and not use the no data as a crutch. Because no policymaker is gonna go for that. They want some form of evidence. So I think it's up to us to be creative in how we concoct that evidence.
I would also say I think it's what kind of evidence they want. So some people really want financial evidence, and that's what they're looking for. Other people have a kid that was sick, and what they want to see is that kids aren't going to be sick in the future. So it's also really listening and thinking about your audience. And as everybody talked about, the way we communicate it and the data we're using, yes, we need, as scientists and as good public health people, we want to make sure it's really good evidence. But what else do we need to do also to answer those questions? And as Jen said, it may be a quick analysis. It may be sharing a study of what's happened in another community, being very conscious that there's some communities that people identify more with than others because they're from similar states or similar type of environments, et cetera. But it's, a lot of it, I think, is also framing the data and making sure you're being strategic about how you communicate it. Anything else from y'all? Anybody else in the audience on the data question? And then I'll go back to questions. Specifically on this? Go ahead.
Anecdotes do work. Yep. They're not very science, but for legislators, sometimes the anecdote of a particular family or setting makes a difference.
Great. And I had promised to go back here, and then I'll come back off. Great. So I think the question was just, is there a time when HIA would not be, I mean, it's an adequate approach, or, go ahead.
It might not be needed. It might not be necessary.
Sure, I would, I guess I would just add that if HIA might not be a necessary approach if health is already being considered in the decision-making process. Was there another part to this?
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. I'm loud.
I'm going to try and channel you next time. I guess HIA wouldn't be necessary if health is already being brought to the table in a decision-making process. I'm not sure if I missed other parts of the question, but that the HIA piece really comes into action, into play when decision-makers haven't considered that piece of information. And that way you can then get community involved, you can look at the health disparities data, you can see how those effects will spread disproportionately. Meredith, did you have another point?
So I'll just add one or a couple other points. I think ideally, yes, you know, it'd be great if we could get to a place where health is always at the table, health is always being considered, and that it's done in a really meaningful way. But I do think that there are sometimes advantages to the HIA approach. So in health and all policies, we have a relationship with these organizations. And so sometimes we actually have to make the call as to, you know, it's a compromise. And sometimes we have to understand that, you know, the priorities of our partner organizations may have to take priority this time, and that health may not be as central as we want it to be. But we also have to do that to maintain the relationship. So I would say health and all policies is a long-term relationship strategy that, you know, we're going to constantly be building in health and equity, but it may not happen all at once. And so I do think that there are times when HIA can be a little bit, I guess they can be blunt. You know, they can actually say, like, you know, actually, you know, this is one of those times where we shouldn't be compromising, maybe. And I think that sometimes, at least in health and all politics, we actually need to take, it's a dance, you know, it's a relationship dance, and we have to make sure that we're maintaining those relationships over time, so.
And just can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the other thing, too, is also thinking about the way that we define health, because I think sometimes it becomes a turnoff to some partners when you're looking at finding a cure for cancer, because other folks feel that's not possible. So can you come to a more proximal step towards finding a cure for cancer? You know what I'm saying? So instead of saying that we're going to try to fix the whole problem, can you think about that first incremental step and define health in that way? So maybe it's just modifying behavior. It's not being the final change in health status. I think that's the other thing. That's what I was thinking when you first started asking the question.
Great. I know.
I have been working a lot in preconception healthcare, and I've read a lot of literature published and everything, and one of a couple of publishers, authors, have published about preconception frontier policy. They argue that there is no enough evidence that prompts us to develop a policy, a sub-policy, just to include preconception from caring to looking care of each other and each women. So on the other hand, if you look at small interventions, well, not such small community, but if you look at specific interventions such as diabetes control, folic acid intake, in patients before pregnancy, all of them, we have enough evidence from all of them. What we don't have is evidence that if you put all of them together, you're going to get better results. So that's kind of a challenge in terms of how to move forward and how to start, policymakers to think about it with that type of information.
So I'll start just really quickly, and that's just that, one reason I think that we're doing this law and health policy project and why in general this discussion is so important is that we don't know all the answers. We don't work with these other sectors. A lot of things are changing. And so I think we want to make sure that we know what the evidence base is out there, that we can tell people if we know it works, but we certainly don't want everybody to stop and wait until you have the perfect evidence to do anything. And so I think as you're saying, if we're going to do something, then it's also really important that we evaluate and we research, is it working, so that we can make tweaks and we can make changes. And I think, people always say in public health, it's very rare that we have a randomized control trial. You're not going to get one group of people, you try all these things on and see what's going to happen necessarily. What can we do to really share those things that are working, to get people to consider them? And as people try different things, we talk about states and localities being this, laboratories of democracy. How do we make sure that as different laws get put into place, we see which ones are working, which ones are being implemented well, what different things are happening that make a difference? And that also is important. And so hopefully, I know people do stop things based on that we don't have the perfect evidence and we don't know what works. But then the answer, I think, hopefully is, we got to do something. Let's try it. How can we evaluate and make sure we learn what happens? And I think that's something that together we'd all like to think of, how do we get to that answer back to people and how can we help? But I know others will want to jump in on this, probably around the room. Was that on this? Okay.
I would agree with what Angie said, and I think it is a matter of making a compelling enough argument that if you have this other body of evidence, how could it translate over here to the particular topic? But I think it's also how compelling are you in making the case to a policymaker to make sure that that evaluation piece is there. I think sometimes people get frustrated when there's a sunset provision in a particular law. I don't think it's a bad idea. In my opinion, we should not be putting laws into place in perpetuity if we don't know that they work, regardless of what it is. And so if you can persuade a policymaker that, there is enough evidence in this other area that we should be trying it here, put it in place for a period of time, and make sure that there's a mandated evaluation to go along with it. Now, the funding is a whole other issue. But the evaluation, there are plenty of students in schools of public health that are happy to get their hands on data and look at these things. So.
Thanks, that's great. Well, I'm going to go here and then I'll come right back to you.
I'm looking at Dr. Denberg here, who's been also answer that question. But I think it's through the governor who made that Board of Health, and the Board of Health, I believe, is the one.
It goes to the State Board of Health on the field, or the State Board of Health, then the staff is one or two people who are from a lot, a relatively small number of requests, as they do a good job and attack for requests, they're going to have to go back and get more staff.
So they are
on the card
just to
okay.
The
yeah,
Yes, you're next. I can't see now.
But I just gotta say, opportunistic isn't necessarily bad.
Right. Okay.
You're moving forward.
Oh yeah.
So.
Health and all policy or health and all policy-like strategies pop up, and oftentimes they've been going on for years and years and years, and they're just being called different things. And I think that's totally not only fine, I think that's good to own whatever you want to call it. I think there are lots of local examples, and I'm happy to. I know that NICHO has some information about some of the local examples. We do some tracking ourselves just because we give a lot of we do a lot of calls. People call us and ask for assistance. And so we have a pretty good idea of who, at least in California, is doing it. So I can talk afterwards and give you some more examples and help put you in touch. There are also, there's going to be a couple other panels that our team is helping to organize. There's one tomorrow, and it's with the City of Richmond, the County of Monterey. I'm looking to Julia, who else is going to be on that panel. Anyway, there's a number of locals that are all doing health and not policy. There's health and not policy-like strategies. And so I think that might be a really great opportunity to hear from some of the folks on the ground doing it. But yeah, I think it sounds like it's great work that you're starting to do. And I think that, you know, whether or not, you know, health and not policies can, I think, be formed in many ways. A lot of times it started with a specific issue and then it expands. Or, you know, in some cases like us, we actually had a state top-down mandate, but oftentimes I think especially we're seeing more of single topic area, and then they start to build those relationships, and, you know, as you build the relationships and as you're able to identify more common areas to work on, then it kind of just naturally grows, and being opportunistic is, I mean, the way to do it.
I was going to say, I really liked the expression they use, health lens, and so you're starting to work with partners and make these connections, and I think that's great. Sorry, Nick.
Yeah, my name is Jake Holm. I've served as a representative for AGHA on 8 national standards committees for built environment over the last 20 years. So I think I'm going back to first in the area, and EPHA has adopted 3 policies on that matter in the last 15 years. I want to switch the topic slightly toward another aspect of health, which is very, very rarely discussed, which is the prevention and mitigation of injuries, specifically in the home. There are 2 categories of injuries which get short shrift in these conferences. I don't know when the last time they were discussed, I think it was 2 years ago. That's stair-related injuries and bath and shower-related injuries. Together, they comprise of over 3 million medically treated injuries a year, and at a societal cost of roughly $150 billion a year. To what extent are the various activities and considerations you have discussed addressing those areas, and specifically with respect to state and local building codes for construction?
That's not an area we've worked on as much. In our more in like an active transportation, we're thinking about accessibility of active transportation for across the spectrum, across the life spectrum. But we haven't worked as much thinking about in-home and small, but though it is, it's a pretty big area that you should be thinking about.
Recently, the Health Impact Project through the Pew Charitable Trust put out a competition this past summer to recognize HIA practitioners, HIAs, that really led to positive health outcomes and changing the determinants of health. And there is one example from Oregon where they, I guess it was the, I'm not sure of the agency exactly, but they conducted an HIA to inform the state's budget decision to actually allow for the federal housing dollars to be used for reconstruction of modular homes. And we awarded an, an honorarium to a grantee out in Oregon who, through the HIA, was able to identify some of these health outcomes that you mentioned and really change actual housing standards, mobile housing standards, manufactured housing standards in the state, and are still working to try and get at that state level decision to use the federal dollars. They're showing that through changing these standards, they're able to impact positively changes in health, reducing falls, reduce in air quality, negative air quality outcomes for individuals living in manufactured homes that have mold and asbestos. And so I guess that's one example that HIA was able to be used to, I guess, make affect positively the health outcomes of a community.
And I'll give you just one other example related to our work, but not necessarily one of the reports that Tiffany told you about, and that's that the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, where we work, we recently worked with the American College of Preventive Medicine to host a Healthy Aging Summit. And so as part of that, falls, of course, were one of the huge issues and the injuries related to it. What we had done as part of thinking around how do we have law and policy incorporated more into Healthy People 2020, as we looked at the older adult objectives under Healthy People 2020, and the public health law program at CDC, who works with us, helped us to think through what legal and policy interventions work with these older adult ones. And of course, there were a number around falls, and I'm happy to share that material if you'd like. Go ahead.
I'd like to just follow up.
Sure.
I think I'm the only older adult in the room. I'm well into my 70s. And I know a lot about falls in the elderly. I know a lot about falls across the ages. And the problem right now, and I'll be very blunt about this, mm-hmm. most of the money in falls in the elderly is related to built environments. And the emphasis is in this place because the fastest growing population experiencing falls is the under 65 population, particularly people of age in this room. Mm-hmm. And it really hurts when I see so much money being poured into falls in the elderly, when it's really money going down the drain. There's a lot of research, most of it isn't very good, in relation to built environment issues. And what I really need to see, or what we really need to see, is a focus on falls across the entire age spectrum, from children to older folks. That's the only way we're going to prevent it through infecting the built environment. All those other measures won't work. I'm sorry, I'm being very long about that. I'm very public on this subject, by the way.
Good. That's why we're all here, to share and learn, so that's good. Thank you. In back.
My name is Julie Kaplan. I work with Barrett in California, and I had a comment about the HIA and health and all policies link, and I'm also curious for reactions from the panel. So while we have not used HIA ourselves with our agency partners, we have used the findings of other people's HIA to inform our work. So for example, I can't remember, maybe it's Minnesota did an HIA on state guideline on school facilities citing, and we've shared that with our Department of Education and are using their findings to guide the partnership around entering from where we are, where we felt like we don't need to do it again, but we can learn from that. So I'm curious if others of you are seeing that start to happen more as HIA can be used part of body literature. And then I also wanted to just make a quick plug for a couple other panels that are, I think, kind of building on what you're talking about here. One of the Meredith mentioned that tomorrow is about it's a number of health and all policy stories from around California. but there's also another panel tomorrow that has got examples of health and policy from Texas, Oregon, Chicago, and California, and then on Wednesday we have an international panel with some pretty big names, local leaders who have been in health and policy for quite a lot longer than many of us in the U.S. So I hear flyers by the door. I'm curious if there are comments about using the HIE funding to support other projects.
Thanks, Julia. Good to see you. you were right about the Minnesota one. That was Minnesota. I think others that are making that connection would be Minnesota as the state. The Department of Public Health is really making an effort to make a regional capacity building effort for health impact assessment. And so similar to other newer topics like criminal justice and education, using HIA, people have been using the findings of other HIAs, and not just the findings or the recommendations, but using that process, that HIA process, to really support the use of health impact assessment, and maybe not starting completely from scratch.
I think we have time for one more question, and then I'll let kind of wind up for a couple more.
Barry Shepard from Boston. The policy can be interpreted a lot of different ways. It can be like a resolution, something that's very binding, something that's non-binding, something that is actual law. I'm curious, from your perspective, how you maybe dealt with that tension when you're looking at a particular intervention or strategy, because it could signal a very first step, but you never hear revisited again, and at the same time, legislation may be so binding that if you learn it, maybe you can't change it. I'm just kind of curious how you deal with it.
I'll just say yes. And in particular, just pulling back to the HIA example, in California, we have on numerous occasions had discussions about whether or not we should have a state policy or a state legislation around doing HIA. And we've had many conversations about, is that actually, do we want that? You know, do we want legislation? And similarly around health and health policies, we don't have legislation. Our task force is codified in some unrelated statute, but we are not, you know, legislated. And I think that in some ways that's actually there's really good things about that. So a lot of the flexibility and the being opportunistic, when you codify something in law, you oftentimes lose a lot of that flexibility. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we do that is about the building relationships and building the trust that we do behind closed doors, which I actually think is needed and a very important role for stakeholders, external stakeholders, but I also do think there's an important role to have that closed door conversation where you can help internally build the capacity for folks that really talk about the issues, harder to talk about the issues. And if, for example, we were legislated, my guess is those meetings would then be required to be public open forums that, you know, as soon as the public's in the room, everybody's mouth is just closed. They're not going to talk about the struggles they're having. So I think there are pluses and minuses. Maybe it's easier to get funding for this work if it was legislated. Potentially last longer, you know, have the potential to be longer lasting. Trade-off.
The other thing I would just add to it is when you first started seeing policies, I think instead of just looking to laws, we can also look at institutional policies. And so sometimes I think, you know, we talk about public health innovation is local and people think of local health departments, but it also could be within institutions where they're being innovative because they can be more nimble and they're not being held to the same prying eyes and restrictions and that type of thing. So, you know, I think if somebody is trying it, if it's a corporation, if it's a school, whatever, that's trying a particular policy, then we should always be there with eyes open to learn what we can. And maybe that's a way when we're talking in terms of the data, whether it's anecdote, maybe we look and say, look, in this small micro example in this one institution, here was their experience. And so can we learn from that and ramp it up? And maybe that's sort of the incremental step to if we want a policy as a law, or if we say, you know what, we don't want that. It's better to be flexible and to be nimble, and it would be a detriment if we actually made it law.
Yeah, and I'm going to jump in because I'm the moderator and I can't. But so I think, you know, when we define policy and law, when we say law, we're actually reading it very broadly to include all of those different elements. But I think each of them have their place. And so I know often immunizations, you may have a law that they're mandates, but the actual immunization schedule and things like that, it's much better for it to be done through administrative means, whether a regulation or other thing, a policy, because you can look more frequently with the scientific updates and it's then the public health folks and the doctors and others who are updating it rather than it going through the legislator. I think totally things like what's going on out in the field. I know one thing that as lawyers we always have to throw in though, when caution officer was looking for things like preemption, and so often laws can end up being a ceiling rather than a floor for what happens. And so what can we do if we're coming up with laws to make sure that we're still really encouraging innovation? And so often that's a place where codifying it is amazing sometimes, but we have to really think through what are those unintended consequences that also can emerge. And either way, once again, this is, I guess, my theme for the day, is then we need to evaluate it and make sure we know what's happening so we can tell people. So. All right, one other question from folks, and if not, I will let. Okay, so I want to let everybody wrap up. If there's something that you really wanted to put in your presentation and didn't have a chance, or has come up during the discussion that you wanted to tell people about, this is your chance.
I just wanted to mention that the Health Impact Project is looking to conduct an evaluation of the field. You know, we talk a lot about HIA and how it leads to positive health outcomes, and it was mentioned on the panel today that it's really hard to articulate that. And so we're really looking at how, we'd like to really look at how HIA impacts the determinants of health, and then how that can ultimately lead to positive health outcomes. And we're also interested in finding out those lessons learned from the field and what is needed, what factors are needed to successfully implement health into consideration, or health into policy making, and then promote positive health outcomes. And then to the note about tools, we're hoping to develop a clearinghouse. I say that we are a national convener of information on our site, but we're really trying to hone in on the field and what has been done already to help others, whether it's making a policy or helping decision makers come up with a checklist to include health in decision making. I think that bottom line is that health is at the table when necessary. And thank you again for allowing me to be here today.
Okay, just because it was brought up, I wanted to touch on evaluation as well. I think that this is an area that in California at our Health and Law Policies Task Force we've been thinking about for a really long time and haven't had a really good opportunity to do evaluation. We've done a process evaluation that we did a few years ago, and we do a lot of tracking and monitoring of different things, but we've never engaged in a robust, in-depth evaluation, and that's an area we're really, really struggling with. So I'm really grateful for some of the minds in this room that we, as Jennifer mentioned, we're actually, well, about sharing out ideas, as we actually working with some colleagues down in LA. Lauren Gates is developing a framework for health and law policies and what we think, how it should be evaluated or how it could be evaluated. And so if you're interested in learning more and helping us and actually providing some input on that, we'd love your opinions and thoughts. We're literally developing it like back as we speak. So I think that's a great opportunity. And I think in terms of moving this field forward, you know, everybody here is talking about, most everybody's talking about health and law policies, but there's not been a really great example of a really, really good evaluation. South Australia, who's about 10 years ahead of us, is in the midst of doing one. It's a 5-year long evaluation. They're in year like 3 or 4. But in the US, we haven't had one. And so I think that's an area for growth.
Okay. So one, I just want to thank our speakers for their great presentation. So first, let's...